The billionaire Warren Buffett once said, "Bill Child represents the best of America in matters of family, philanthropy, business, or just plain citizenship. Anyone who follows in his footsteps is heading true north." In today's episode, I have the pleasure of interviewing Bill Child. Bill serves as chairman of the board of R.C. Willey Home Furnishing. Under his management, the company has grown over the past 52 years from one employee to over 3,000. From a 600-square-foot store to 14 large stores in Utah, Idaho, Nevada, and California, with an annual sales volume of over $800 million. And in 1995, R.C. Willey was acquired by Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. And you'll notice throughout the episode, I ask a lot of questions referring to Bill's biography, which is called How to Build a Business Warren Buffett Would Buy, the R.C. Willey Story by Jeff Benedict, and I would highly recommend reading it. It's an incredible read, and I learned a lot about business and just life in general from reading it. So I hope you guys enjoy this week's episode, and let's get right into it.
So anyway, when I took it over, he made money, but the last 3 or 4 years he hadn't, because he had more expenses than income.
Mm-hmm.
And his income, his margins were very low. And but he was making a good living, and that's basically all he cared about.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have an accountant.
Did he have other employees, or was it just him working?
Just him. Well, he finally, when he built the store, he had to hire someone.
Because, okay.
He was a delivery guy and a repair guy and everything else before he built the store. But he was forced to build the store because mm-hmm. he'd been selling cheaper than his competitors. And the competitors were complaining he had no overhead. He didn't have a store.
Yeah.
And or a storefront, and so had no employees except him, and so he was, his overhead was really low, and he was making enough money to have a very good living. Yet $10,000 a year would have been huge at that time, and I don't think he ever made $10,000 a year, but he made $4,000 or $5,000 a year.
Yeah.
But then when he built the store, he had to hire a man to do the delivery and do the repairing, because he had to stay there in the store. He found out that it was really advantageous to have a customer come in and see 5 or 6 refrigerators, or maybe 8, rather than the one on the back of his pickup truck.
Mm-hmm.
So that made it, that was a real step forward for him, and that gave him actually a real boost in his business. And in fact, he went from probably $50,000 to $75,000 a year door to door up to $157,000.
Wow.
That was his best year.
Just knocking doors and selling appliances?
Put them
wow.
in.
Uh huh.
Well, I think his first year or two was maybe $20,000 to $25,000, and he probably made 7 or 8% of it, so
yeah.
He'd make $5,000 or $6,000, but that was more money than he could make.
Yeah,
working for the power company.
Mm-hmm.
So it really worked out quite well.
And
he did that for 18 years. Then in finally 1970. Let's see, 1950. That's when I took over. So 1949 is when he built the first store, and the one store, 600 square feet. It was about the size of this here area.
Really?
But it was a store.
Yeah.
He had a telephone line extension from the house that had 9 parties on it. He had no air conditioning. He had no water. No bathroom facilities.
Wow.
Had 4 parking places, but he complied. He was at least legal. He had a storefront, he had some overhead, and then of course he had to hire a person, and he paid him pretty well. I buried his daughter in 1954. And so, right shortly after I was dating her, well, I graduated from college in 54, but I married her in probably, I think 2000, maybe, I can't even remember exactly when it was. It was, I graduated from high school in 1950, and I was dating her then a year later, so it'd be 1951.
Okay.
That's when we got married. And I was working at, or going to Weber State, and I went there for a year on a kind of a scholarship. Ran track, by the way.
Oh, really? Yeah. Cool.
And so actually in those last 3 years, the last 2 years, we built a house in Syracuse. I'd saved a little bit of money and so forth, and R.C. really gave me a lot. And we built it right next to his house, just west of the store. And so I would come home on weekends with my wife, and she'd come home and spend time with her. We're living in Salt Lake. And I would prefer to work for help him, even though I didn't ask for any pay or anything,
mm-hmm.
rather than help my dad on the farm. My old brother was getting old enough that he could help the farm. I hated all farm work.
I bet.
I didn't like it at all. And so I learned quite a little bit about the business, and I helped the one delivery guy. His name was Lamar Sessions. I helped him deliver. Helped him put up antennas, and it worked out really well. And R.C. would put $10 under my steering wheel when I'd go back. So I was,
yeah.
You know, when I'd tell him, I'd try to take it back and give it to him, and he wouldn't take it. So I was making about $10 a week.
Cool.
And then during the summer, I went ahead and that last year I worked full time, and I went out and sold door to door. Like he did, and did very well. And 1954 June is when I graduated from college, and I had a teaching contract, teach at North Davis Junior High, and I was quite excited about that. I was going to work during the summer, and you know, some time, a lot of time off.
Yeah, oh yeah,
quite a bit of time off at that time. So anyway, but he handed me the keys and said, I'll be back in about 2 weeks. Came back in about 4 days. We thought he had an ulcer. That's what he was going to go take care of. So when he came back, went right in the hospital, and it was not an ulcer, it was cancer of the pancreas. So he never came out of the hospital. He passed away
mm-hmm.
right shortly after that. And here I was, 22 years old, supposedly running a business. My mother-in-law had, of course, R.C. Willie. My father-in-law liked me. And of course, I was a better candidate than any of the others. There wasn't any other candidates.
Mm-hmm.
His delivery guy wouldn't have made it. And he had a son who was had just gotten his PhD in education. And R.C. had sponsored him, not sponsored him, but financed him all the way through.
Yeah.
He had 4 kids. So, and then he had this man, and then he had another son-in-law who has since passed away, but wasn't qualified. He had a problem. Gambling, alcohol, a little bit. And so he wasn't a salesman either. You had to be a salesman. If you couldn't sell, you just didn't make it. So anyway, I was going to do it for just a while and so forth. Not happy about it. I wasn't excited, but I had no choice. My mother-in-law had, when we finally did a little accounting, we found out that business was deeply underwater.
Okay.
And if we'd have sold it, tried to sell it, or hadn't have made it, the bank would have closed us down. She'd have lost her house, she'd have lost everything, and had no income whatsoever. So my job was try to build it up to, you know, where it was profitable, then we could do something with it.
So what did you do to do that?
How'd I do it?
Yeah.
Well, I worked hard, about 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Wow.
And I had to make the sales because we had a lot of contracts. He had sold on time and sold them to the bank, financed customers and sold them to the bank with nothing down. And it was what we called a farm plant. It's a very complicated situation. But he needed the money to pay these notes that he had on or contracts on these appliances. So even if he had to sell them at cost or below any product, he'd do it because he needed the money to, you know, to make that payment. Mm-hmm. If he didn't make that payment, then he was selling out of trust. Normally, they're supposed to, whenever they sell an appliance, you're supposed to send the money in. But he had done it for so many years, had been, you know, pretty slow with these payments, but always reliable. Mm-hmm. The old president of the bank was a good friend of his, and he was an old bachelor. But he had gone to Europe, so the new president-to-be was a little tougher. He didn't want me writing checks if I didn't have any money in the account. And I said, well, I've looked at the bank statements, and they're the last two or three that I've seen, able to see, are all in the red. And he said, well, that was between Mr. Willie and Mr. Gaby. That's not between Mr. Willie and Barnes Bank. It was Barnes Bank Company out of Kingsville, a good bank. And he was a good guy. I mean, he just was, and he was right. I mean,
yeah,
we were pretty unstable. So anyway, after a lot of years, and so I had to spend my evenings out repossessing or getting new contracts because he was charging all these contracts back to us because they were all full recourse, meaning that if the customer didn't pay, then the dealer had to pay. And since they never checked anybody's credit, the only time they would turn anyone down is if they had bad experiences with them. And a little bank out in Caseville, you know, didn't have a lot of experience with, you know, there was a lot of banks. It was the Clearfield State Bank and the First National Bank, and then there was the bigger banks in Ogden and so forth, and bank in, let's see, I guess it was another bank that did quite a bit of business. Well, mostly Ogden, but there was, you know, other banks. So there you were, a little company that had lost R.C. Willie and lost the guy that was running it for 22 years.
Wow.
Sold door-to-door for 18.
Just that one location for 22 just years?
That was it.
Wow.
Just this size.
Yeah.
And so it was sort of a challenge. It was a big challenge to do it. And you know, we finally got on top of it. The nice part about what he had done, selling so cheap, gave him a good reputation for saving
money. That's true, yeah.
And so people would say, hey, I bought this from R.C. Willie and I saved $50, or I saved $25 or $30 from what I was priced in town, in Ogden, or in, there was a dealer in Clearfield, and there was one in Riverdale, and so forth. Huh. So, and then one or two in Layton, you know, it's a lot of little appliance operations. But obviously he was the cheapest because he really never knew financially how he was doing. He had a bookkeeper, but he wasn't very, he was taking money, and I think he was paying the sales tax, but he wasn't paying income tax, I don't
know. Oh, wow. So you take it over and you've got a bunch of debt?
It's like it's all these problems, you know. And then we had problems,
dang,
mechanical problems with automatic washers. We had this IRS that called me and wanted to look at our books. I'd never seen the books. I says, I don't even know we have books or not.
Yeah. Wow.
So anyway, that was the flag. And I was very honest with the guy. I said, look, I took this thing over, but I... didn't create any of these problems that we have and so forth. I'm just trying to make it go. So anyway, I finally hired the IRS agent, which was a coup to get him, because we never had any penalties. We did have to pay some taxes, and that was tough.
Yeah.
Very difficult. But we at least didn't have to do that.
Yeah, like I remember reading in the book that you hired the IRS guy and he kept your books from then on.
That worked out just great.
Wow, that's crazy.
And since that time, we've never had, well, we had audits every year after that for about 6-7 years, which is standard. But since then, we've never had an audit.
Wow.
And for the last, 30 years, 40 years, of course, we're pretty honest. We try to do everything according to the book. I just wouldn't have it any other way. So we do have a good reputation. But the fact that RC sold so cheap, sometimes even under cost, some of the dealers would say, well, this guy must be buying better.
Yeah, how is he getting those deals?
How can he sell that thing? It cost me that much. And yet he's selling it for that. Mm-hmm. Well, the reason he was selling it for that was the fact that he needed $200 more to put on that, or $300 or $400. So he would have to sell everybody that came in, even if they said, well, we can't afford it.
Yeah.
He'd say, look, I'll put you on a farm plan, which means you can pay it when your crops come in. And most of them were farmers when he was selling door to door, 90%.
That's a good idea, yeah.
But then what he was selling after that was a lot of the military base, Hill Air Force Base, and the naval base, and the arsenal. All those people had pretty good salaries, and he kept saying, well, you know, maybe you could pay it when your taxes come in, or pay part of it. So he'd give them 2 or 3 years. What they say, you know, if the wife wanted an automatic washer, you know, and here's the way to do it, I'll never put anything down. I can pay it over 3 years, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Just one payment a year. But sometimes when that payment come due, they didn't have the money. That's when the bank would, you know. Of course, the bank was not very astute in their collections. And particularly on our account, they were not good at all. So sometimes a person would go 6 months and never get it done, you know.
So what would you do to overcome that?
I'd have to go collect. They'd send me the contract, charge it to my account. And they were doing that when there was no money in the account, or when, because I got some money in the account that I had committed for checks. You know, I'd written checks on that account. Now, once here would come the charge for this, you know, they'd say, oh, there's $2,000 in there, and this contract hasn't paid for 6 months. So they charge it and send me the contract. Then
really?
The checks would hit and there would be no money.
Yeah.
The banker would call me and say, look, you don't have any money in the account. I told you, you were not supposed to write checks if you didn't have the funds in the bank. And I said, well, I did have the funds in the bank. Then I'd go out in the mailbox and there'd be that contract.
Yeah.
So I finally had to change banks.
Okay.
And because it was so tough.
Yeah.
And so that was a good lesson. Because I never have had a mortgage on a building since then.
Wow.
We were able to build, to expand only if we have the money.
Really?
And having a good reputation helped, because we had a base of customers. And then when I decided to get into the furniture, that helped a lot, because that just almost doubled our business and gave us a lot more products. And my furniture showroom, at first, was my garage down the street.
Oh, so you had the one store and then your garage where you kept the furniture?
Yeah, my garage.
Wow.
Selling upholstery pieces.
Really?
No. And I did very well. And so I finally made a real estate deal. Ended up with $10,000 and built on the first expansion, 2,200 square feet.
Wow.
And so that got us in the furniture business. And we kept expanding a little bit every few years, as quick as we had the money, because our business was growing. The economy was good, and Hill Air Force Base was really expanding.
Yeah.
And that was a source of our customers, was pretty much And I think we probably sold about 90% of them. They would tell one another, because the system will die down in the country. If you need the furniture, if you need appliances. Most of these people would, because the military, and there was about 3,000 of them, would be rotated about every 3 years.
Well, so you got fresh customers every 3 years.
So the same customers would come back and buy 3 years later, a lot of them. And so that was a super situation.
Yeah. I read from your book that you went from 250,000 to 250 million in sales. How did you do that? What were the steps?
Well, it took us
four years. Yeah.
It was every day was a new day. Every year was a new year. And I was very fortunate to hire good people and to expand on good, solid principles of honesty and integrity and taking care of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of a miracle because when I took over, I think we had 45 or 42 different competitors. And today none of them are, well, there's only one that survived. It's a company called Kiesel Sales and Service.
Huh.
It was a one-man operation then, and it's probably two men today or three men, something Ogden.
Yeah.
But the rest of them are all gone.
Crazy.
And so they just didn't expand. They didn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, they, you only close a business if it isn't profitable. When it becomes unprofitable, then it's, you either decide to retire or get out of it, or kids don't want it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, but we just kept building and building, and we wanted to be better every year and improve every year. And we knew those all through those years that we were going to have more costs. Our expenses were going to go up. They did every year. And so we had to either do more volume or more margin, or maybe a combination of two. And so we did. If we offered more service,
okay,
we could charge a little more for it. Or if we offered it, we got savings that we could buy things a little cheaper than maybe some of our competitors.
Yeah.
Then, of course, we could give a little better deal. And, so,
and you were also one of the first to offer in-house credit, correct? Did that help bring in more customers?
Yeah, we were the first one in this area to do that. That was a real coup for the simple reason that there was a law in the books that we, all, of course, we did offer credit, but we always had to sell the contracts.
Yeah.
And we went through a lot of companies, commercial credit, Stravel, Patterson, I think, so had some. And then, of course, the banks had, did some of it. When we first started, it was all bank. But anyway, General Electric credit. And it was kind of a problem because once we would give them so much business, then they would be tough on our customers and turn people down that shouldn't be turned down. So we felt like if we could carry our own and do it wisely, we would be much ahead. And then there was this law in the books. It was called the installment basis of reporting income. It was set up for jewelers who would sell a ring to someone. I would say he wanted to give his wife or his fiance a ring, but he only didn't have hardly any money. So he'd go in and maybe buy a $200 ring, and he'd probably put $20 down.
Yeah.
And then $20 a month, which was being financed. But anyway, the jeweler would have to pay taxes on it before he collected most of the money. So they set up this rule that says you can, as long as you haven't collected it, you don't have to pay taxes on it.
Hmm.
So if it's on the books and it's a credit on your books, then you can deduct. Then you don't, there's no taxes.
Yeah. Huh.
So we assumed that if we could sell the product and build our accounts receivable higher, there was other compliances to do, but all that money would be tax-free for a while.
Yeah, that's true. Sooner or later,
we had to pay taxes on it when the contracts were paid off. But if we could keep adding more volume in the finance area, then we got up to where we had about $7 million worth of tax-free money.
Wow.
That we were using. We used that to expand.
Yeah.
And then they closed the law. But they gave us, I think, 4 years to pay it all, pay the taxes.
Okay.
So once a year, which was worked out really great. And that's why we were able to build without getting a mortgage and going to the bank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that was one of the coups we did. Another thing that was good in the advertising, TV was just coming on.
Okay.
And the TV spots were running anywhere from $50 up to $1,200, of course, $500 to $1,000 or to $2,500 now, considerably more. Of course, the problem too is that we only have three stations.
That's true. Right here in Salt Lake.
So you knew exactly. It was very easy because I think KSL was getting 50% of the business, and Channel 4 was getting 25%, and Channel 2 was getting 25%. So, you know, it's very easy to know to place your spots. So I went to KSL and asked them, because I saw a lot of spots that were not being used because TV was just coming on.
Yeah.
And I said, look, if I could buy every spot and pay, yeah, I think it was $50. It could have been $100. I can't remember. That you're not using, that has a value of maybe $300 up to $1,000. Would you let me buy all those spots that are going to waste? And they said, come back and said, yeah, we'll do it. Don't tell anybody.
Yeah, because they're losing money anyway, so that's brilliant just to go in and say.
Anything. They were getting something out of it.
Yeah.
And it was, rather than, you know, be promoting KSL, you can only promote it so much. So it, for about 2 or 3 years, that worked great. The rep would come out, you know, our salesman would come out and he'd say, well, you spent $20,000 for advertising, but it only cost you $8,000 or $6,000. I'd say, oh my gosh, what a bargain. You know, it was less than 50%.
Yeah.
And so wow. We spent a lot of money. And we had a campaign. We made our own spots.
Yeah, tell me about your Never on Sunday
campaign. Yeah, that was one of our programs. Well, there was a lot of national companies that come in, and they were all going to be open. Everyone was closed on Sunday there for a long time. Not everyone, but most. And all at once, these national companies came in and were open on Sunday. And we thought, gosh, you know, how do we compete with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you're giving them your competitor a day, an extra day, when the guy shops, if he can go down there and buy, but he can't come out and buy from you.
Yeah, that's
sure,
big.
Close. You're not going to open on Sunday. So we put in that Never on Sunday thing, and we had a guy that would say Never on Sunday, Ray LeBrec, and he was quite a guy. He was good. He was one for it. Well, he was worked in credit, and we put him out as a greeter because he got kind of famous.
From the commercials,
yeah.
Wow.
And so that's when we just had the Syracuse store. And he did a good job for us, and he did a good job. But I would get a... Someone would call me a competitor. I'd meet them in a beautiful meeting. They'd say, how can you spend that much money on TV? I said, well, we're eventually going into Salt Lake, and so we want to build that market. And we're just trying to build the future, which was right. And we want to build our name, because nobody's ever heard of R.C. Willie, not now, nobody, but very few have heard of R.C. Willie out in the country. So our competitors called us, the guy, the dealer out in the meadow or out in the country. And So anyway, that worked out well. I said, it's expensive, but I think eventually it'll pay it off. And eventually it will. Well, boy, it was paying off like crazy. Then we moved into Salt Lake, and it just made all the difference in the world.
Yeah.
Because we had a reputation, we had a name.
That's
and,
big.
That was one of those things that just spurred us. And the sooner popular TV got more popular and they were selling more spots, so we were getting less and less. And so then we had to go into the market and, you know, negotiate a little better. But that worked real well for a
period of time. Yeah.
And the Salt Lake market was good to get into because it gave us a bigger appeal.
Yeah.
The Salt Lake area used to do 50% of all the business in the state. The Ogden area, or northern Utah, was 25%, and Provo and south was another 25%. So if you weren't doing business in Salt Lake, you were going to miss 50% of the population, 50% of the growth, and 50% of the business.
Yeah.
So that was very important. And then, of course, we went north to Ogden, and that worked out well. And we went to Provo, and that worked out well.
So how many locations do you have today?
I think we have 6 or 7 in Utah.
Okay. What about outside of Utah?
The total, I think there's 12 or 13.
Okay. Cool.
We're building another one up in Layton now.
Oh, really? Cool.
But I think, and they're all... they're all good, you know, good stores.
Yeah.
We had one in West Valley. We closed when we built the Draper store.
Okay.
And it's a tough business because you used to have a lot of competitors. You used to have the Granites, the Southeast, the Boyles, the Payless Appliance, you know. And then you had a lot that came in. There was a company called Silo. There was American, or I've forgotten, a big one that was supposed to be really super, super, that came into the market. And you've had so many that came in, but they've all gone out. There isn't hardly any except Best Buy. Let's see, the other one was, and they've closed since. Not Best Buy, they're still...
another store, yeah.
Yeah. I knew the founder of Best Buy. He was a pretty personal friend of mine.
Oh, really?
And he told me, he says, I'll never come to Salt Lake City. And he sold the company. So here they come.
Yeah. Yeah, there's one down in St. George, too.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And they're a good company. They're doing pretty well. They're, I'm trying to think of...
See, with all these stores you have, how do you judge success with all these?
Well, the markets are all fairly similar. There's some difference. Las Vegas is a little different market than some of the others, but most of them we can pretty well buy for the market. We have a... you know, some of them are better than others. There's no question about that. Some markets are better. Reno has been growing like crazy. Boise, which is the one that I built with my own money.
Yeah.
And that is our, last year was our number one store.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's doing over $100 million in sales.
That's incredible.
Store.
Wow.
So it's doing very well.
Is that right off the freeway up there? Cool.
Yeah, you just pull off the... Well, it's an interesting story. I decided we wanted to go to Las Vegas. Warren wouldn't let us go. He didn't think we could be successful and be closed on Sunday. So I proposed Boise. He had the same idea. He says, no, it's not going to work. And so I said, Warren, one day I got up, I was taking a shower, and I says, we've got to move. I've got to see if this company... can be successful outside of Utah and stay closed on Sunday. I said, I think it can. So anyway, I went ahead and called him, and I said, Warren, I'd like to talk about Boise. he said, the first time he's ever been a little gruff with me, he says, we've already talked about voicing, Bill, and we're not going to go. I said, let me make you a deal you can't turn down. I said, I will buy the land, I will build the building, and in 6 months, we're not really successful, we'll close it. He said, and I said, I'll make sure RC really doesn't lose any money. He said, okay. If we can't do $30 million, we'll close it. I said, that's fair enough. Well, the biggest store up there, its volume is only having been around $27 million. So we had a little stretch. He said, then if that's the case, I'll pay you 4% of sales. I'll lease it from you. I said, well, that's fine. I'll do even better. I'll sell it back to you exactly what I paid for it. He said, okay. So he hung up. He may have had something on his mind or something, bigger deal.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I went back in and told the guys, we were just in our staff meeting. I says, we're going to Boise. And we got to do it right. This is our one chance to move out of state. It's the only chance we're going to get. If we are not successful there, we're not going to go to Vegas. We're not going to go to any other place.
Yeah.
So anyway, we went ahead and started working on it. He did call me back, though, and he says, Bill, I can't let you do that. I said, there's no down, no upside for you. It's all downside. I says, oh, no, there's an upside. What is it? He said, well, if we're successful there, you'll let us go to Vegas. He said, okay, all right. Well, it was, my son-in-law said, that was the dumbest deal you've ever made. I mean, it was a good deal, but the 4% of sales on $100 million worth of sales would have been $4 million a year.
Yeah.
Net.
Wow.
So, and you only spent $12 or $13 million in it. So it would have been a terrific investment.
Yes. Yeah.
I was willing to do it, and I would have done it again because we wanted to get into Boise. Oh, we did $50 million the first year.
Wow.
So it was very successful.
Yeah.
And today it's a $100 million store. It's probably the most profitable store in our chain.
Wow. What have you done to make it that way? Why is that one doing so well?
The market was good. And we didn't have any tough competitors. And we were offering the customer something that they couldn't get from the other competitors. We could give them next day delivery.
Oh, wow.
And we could give them a bigger selection. And we were buying a lot of our product overseas at half the price of what the competitors were paying for it. And we had some very fine merchandise coming in. It was terrific. A lot of our manufacturers were even buying overseas and then turning around and selling it to the retailers. And so we could, I was in China. I went to China probably 20 times, and Vietnam, and Malaysia, Indonesia. But I saw product coming off the line in China that had Thomasville on it. And it happened to be one particular item. It happened to be a little dining room table. And we could buy the thing for direct China for about $200. We could buy it from Thomasville, who wanted us to take their line on at the time.
Yeah.
And they were going to sell it to us for $400. And we'd have had to sell it for $750 or
so. Yeah. Wow.
And then they were going to give us 10% off. But, you know, look, when you could buy it direct,
I know, you can't pass that up.
From the Chinese manufacturers. And the Chinese manufacturers were very loyal. In other words, they wouldn't put Thomasville name on it, but they would give us practically the same product. And we would pay, I think it was less than $200 for it.
Wow.
That's a five-piece set. So anyway, that was one of the things that gave us a real spurt, because we were more competitive, more than competitive. we offered a better value to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're still trying to do, is offer a better value to the consumer.
Yeah, exactly. What was it like working with Warren Buffett? Like, how did you get into contact with him?
He was fabulous. He was smaller, of course. You know, he was probably worth 10 or 15 billion instead of 60 or 75 billion. And we even had him in our own home. And he took me to Augusta to play golf with me and Bill Gates.
Really?
Paul Murphy and Steve Ballmer.
Wow, that was a cool experience.
Great experience. And learned a lot from him. And a lot of his, you know, principles of, you know, just thrift, integrity. He's a very honest. A handshake is, if you just get a handshake from Warren, that's all you need. Or if he says, that's okay, you do it, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But he is the most, probably one of the most honest, most ethical people I've ever met in the business world.
What makes you say that?
Well, through experience, a lot of things that I've watched him. You know, I used to talk to him probably twice a week, once a week at least, for 7 years. So I got a pretty good read, and I tried to read about everything, you know, his actions and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Just a few things you know, we mentioned and so forth. We wanted to move into St. George. I did. And there's a company down there, a good company, Boulevard. And one of the guys that was running it at the time mentioned something, I can't remember, he said that I told them that we would not move into St. George. And I think what I said was, we're not going to move into St. George now. Didn't say we would never.
Yeah, just not at the moment.
Yeah, I said, but, well, at one time we were thinking they wanted to sell us the company. And when they thought we were going to move into St. George. And they didn't really want to sell it, but they made that. And then they said, one guy, I guess he sent Warren a letter, and he said, Bill Childs said he would never move into St. George. I said, Warren, I told him that we would not move into St. George immediately, but not, I never said never.
Yeah.
And so anyway, and Warren said, no, if they think you said that, we won't go. No, we can't do it.
Hmm. Wow. And then when he bought the company, he sold it to you in shares of his company, correct? And didn't he give you extra shares on accident? And you mind telling me that story?
Yeah, well, I took all stock, which was great. He made us a deal. My son, who's an attorney, he and another attorney were working together. They wanted to take some cash, some stock. I wouldn't take all stock, but they thought it was wise that we could take some cash out.
Why only stock?
Because,
is it tax less?
Yeah, I wanted the stock because the stock had been moving up.
Mm-hmm.
And this friend of mine said, no matter what you do, take stock. And I said, you're probably right. He said, we sold our company for $60 million. And had we taken stock, it would have been worth over $1 billion today.
Wow.
And that was the Nebraska furniture market. And so anyway, we're close to $1 billion today. So anyway, I thought stock would have been the best way. And you could sell your stock, and of course you had to pay taxes on it when you sold it, but we could take stock out, cash out, tax-free, some of it. But we never could figure out exactly how to do it legally and not be having to pay taxes on it. so finally he called me one day, and I said, well, we're still working on it, Warren. He said, well, look, I can't help you with taxes on it, but I will add another $5 million to the pot. So he had increased the price of what he was going to pay us by $5 million more, which was, I said, oh my gosh, you don't have to do that. But he said, yeah, I'd like to do it. I'd like to do it. I said, okay, you got all, that's a deal, it's all stock. And that was a blessing, because had I not have had stock, I would have, we'd have had this river park, this Hawaiian project that I got into later. And it was going to be a small partner. I have actually ended up being a major partner, because...
So a resort in Hawaii?
A resort in Hawaii. I was the only one that had come up with any money in 2008 when we were building condominiums. And the market had collapsed. Real estate had dropped 50%. And banks wouldn't loan on condominiums. They wouldn't loan on real estate. It already dropped 50%.
Yeah.
Here we were. We had 200 people working there, spending $2 million a month. And we owed the bank a considerable amount of money. One bank that wanted their money on a real short-term loan. We owed the contractor. We owed the architects. And the banks wouldn't loan you money. Where do you get it? Partners had no money to put in it. They were all in real estate somewhat, and so they'd all been hurt.
Yeah.
So Berkshire Hathaway stock was a real blessing. I was able to go to, the financial companies would loan on Berkshire. And they, but I was able to go to Germany and work with Deutsche Bank and borrow money at a very, very, very reasonable rate, pledging Berkshire Hathaway stock.
Wow.
So I was able to pay off the bank, pay off the contractor, pay our current bills. We cut our staff from 200 people down to 100. We had to keep going to keep our licenses and permits. Other than that, we would lose them. And this was the first phase. We built, we're buildings. I think it was 70, maybe 85 condos. And by the way, we had about 50 or 60 of them sold.
Wow.
When that financial crisis hit, 2008, they all backed out. So we had to refund their money.
Yeah.
Money we didn't even have, hardly. But we refunded it all, every penny. I mean, if they couldn't afford it, didn't think they could afford it, so we had to start all over again, basically. But now it's very profitable.
Really?
Doing very, very well. Of course, it's been 9 years. And it wasn't profitable for about 7 of those 9.
Yeah. So what's it called in Hawaii? Where is it at?
It's called Kōloa Landing.
Okay.
K-O-L-O-A Landing.
Cool.
It's a beautiful resort. It turned out
very
really well. In fact, we have been turning people down this year. We just don't have enough rooms.
Do you go there a lot and stay?
I was over there every other month for 7 years. Now it's about 4 times a year.
Huh. Cool. That's a cool picture with you and Buffett right there.
Oh, yeah.
Where's that at?
I don't remember where that was. That was somewhere he was handing me his wallet.
Oh, yeah.
Here's our pictures of our Bill Gates. And Bill Gates and Warren.
Yeah. How cool.
It's been a terrific experience to be, just to work with him.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a highlight of really of my life, I think.
Yeah.
So many ways. Business life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I learned a lot from my father-in-law, R.C. Willie. And my brother worked with me for 30 years, which was very good. Very great.
And then he got a calling in church, right? General authority, right?
He's been very involved. He's been an area president, second corps in the 70s, first corps in the 70s.
Wow.
Captain president. He's now in charge of Adamund, Wyoming.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
So he's doing really.
Yeah.
He's not good.
Because he kind of had to back out of the company once he got that first calling, right?
He couldn't, function.
Yeah. So how involved are you today with the company?
Well, Warren Buffett thinks I'm still involved. I'm the chairman of the board, but I really don't. I give some input, but not a lot. I'm more of a cheerleader.
Okay. Yeah.
And I spent most of my time with the situation and Hawaii.
Yeah.
That's been the big.
What other investments have you made besides that resort?
We have a little investment called River Park. That's the. It's an office park in West Jordan, South Jordan.
Okay. And you get monthly rentals from companies that come in. And
That's cash flow.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Very well. It's been a good one.
So if we could hop in a time machine right now and travel to any time in your life, and you could tell yourself anything, what would you tell yourself, and when would you go? What point in your life?
Well, that's a good question. Well, some of those periods of time, when I took R.C. Willie over, I wouldn't want to go back and do that again, because that was challenging. That was hard. It was 12 hours a day for 4 or 5 years, 6 years. I would think the time that I, and River Park the same way, I wouldn't want to go back. 2008. That was when I was about 75, probably. That was not a good time.
Huh. What would you tell yourself if you could go back, just not to get into that investment?
What would I tell myself?
Yeah, what would you tell yourself?
Well, I can predict the past, but it's pretty hard to predict the future. You just don't know. Right now, I'm looking at. Company is one of the banks has offered me $50 million on a fixed rate for 5 years. That's to finance. That's financing part of our project. And would it be wise to take it? In other words, it depends on what interest rates are going to do, what the Fed's going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know they're going to drop the rate at 25 basis points. It's pretty common at the end of this month, which will be the 31st. And that'll get it down. It's about 2.5 now, and that'll get it down to 2.25. And there's rumors that it might drop another point. But see, nobody knows.
Yeah,
what's going to happen to the economy? Are we going to get into a recession? We definitely are sometime. We don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big thing. It's like the 2008 recession, which was a very tough one. Nobody knew that that was going to be that tough. I mean, I didn't. Some did, but most people didn't, or they would have prepared differently.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think I would go back to the time when I sold the company to Warren, because that was a great time. We didn't have to sell. We were very profitable, and we owned everything. We had no debt.
Yeah.
And we knew we were going to do well. My only problem there was, who do I turn it over to?
Yeah, that's tough.
My family. I have 8 kids. I'm not sure that some of them may have wanted it, but most of them didn't. They'd seen me work 12 hours a day.
Yeah, they didn't want anything to do with that.
Yeah, and so they. And they'd all received, some stock. So they were all doing very well. My brother, of course, as you mentioned, has moved to the church and grabbed him. And so he was pretty well committed. So I didn't know, how do I get out of this? I mean, I was tickled to death to work with Warren for 7 years, afterwards. And I took the business from 59 million up to 800 million in those 7 years.
Really?
So that was a great time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
and when I retired, we had 3,000 employees plus, doing about 800 million.
How did you, did Warren reach out to you, or did you reach out to Warren?
I reached out to him through a friend of mine, a guy by the name of Irv Blokin, who he had bought that furniture company many years ago.
Oh, okay.
And I asked him if Warren might be interested. We had 5 offers, and they were unsolicited offers. They just come to us because we've been growing 17-18% a year for 20 years.
It's a lot of growth.
Maybe more than that, 30 years, I guess, maybe 40 years. Well, anyway, it looked quite promising. And I turned them all down because there wasn't one of them that would guarantee we'd stay closed on Sunday. And so anyway, I talked to Irv about Warren. I said, you know, Warren bought your company and you've been very happy. He says, oh, it was a blessing for us. And I said, well, we've had 5 offers, but I don't like any of them. You think Warren would be interested? He said, I'll talk to him. I'm going to have lunch with him in a couple of days. So in about a week, Warren calls me. And that was a very nice phone call.
Yeah, I bet.
He said, I understand you're going to sell, you're thinking of selling your company. I said, well, I'd sure like to talk about it. Do you have a few minutes? I told him I was honored that he would call me. It was about 6 o'clock at night here. It must have been 7 in Omaha. So anyway, we chatted for a little while, and I said, well, what would you like us me to do? I said, send me 2 or 3 years financials, and I'll get back with you. How much do you want for it? I said, well, just a fair price. I said, we don't want anyone to buy it and be overcharged and not be happy 5 years from now. So that's basically what we're doing. So, you know, he came back with a price.
Yeah.
And it was a fair price. It was $170 million, I think. And then he added another 5.
Yeah.
These are all figures that are available to anybody.
Yeah.
So that worked fine. And then the fact that we took stock, and the stock was at 22,000 a share, and he locked it in at 22. When we closed, finally, it was $24 a share.
Wow. That's awesome.
And now it's 3,000 plus.
So last question. I'll let you go, but you can prescribe anything to the world for 30 days. What do you tell them to do? And they have to do it.
I would think they need to be civil and do what's best. Leaders definitely should do what's best for the world and their people, humanity. It doesn't make any sense to spend billions of dollars on bombs or weapons of mass destruction to kill people. And I think if they could just sort of follow Christ-like principles, I think it would be wonderful.
Oh yeah,
no
for sure.
No war, no stealing, no murders. Fraud. You know, there's so much deception and fraud. Hacking my emails got hacked. I almost lost $600,000. Thank heavens that the bank was smarter than me.
Yeah. Holy cow. That's nuts.
Now, I was getting an email for funds to purchase another piece of property in Hawaii. And I never got it, never done it. And finally, he called the guy and says, I haven't got that. He says, well, we'll get it to you. But in the meantime, see, they were into my emails. So they sent me one, but they changed the bank. So it wasn't going to the right place. It was going to their pockets.
Really?
Yeah.
Scammed you? Dang.
But you get them. We had one just the other day. Someone sent an email to some of our employees and says, Mr. Child would like to give you a $500 bonus. Please send us your
account number and all that. Social Security number, everything. Wow. Stupid.
Oh, no, I'd like to give them $500, but, I'd like to give it to them instead.
Yeah. Wow.
Some other, instead of having them, just rape and rob these employees of ours over Hawaii.
Yeah. It's too bad.
So I think those things, if we could just get people to be honest, exercise some integrity, and realize that, life's short, and money isn't everything. The reputation and the thing you can do for humanity and for your neighbors and friends,
mm-hmm.
Society is the most important thing.
Yeah.
And family, take care of that. Family comes first.
Yeah, exactly.
That's it for this week's episode. If you enjoyed the podcast or have any feedback, let me know by leaving a review down at the bottom of the podcast page, and I'll see you guys for next week's episode.